The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. The former longtime CEO of Black Entertainment Television, Deborah Lee is one of the Hollywood Reporter's 100 most powerful women in entertainment and an inductee into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame. She is the founder and chairwoman of Leading Women Defined Foundation, an organization of black female thought leaders, and is the co-founder of Monarchs Collective, a group that empowers men and women of color to sit on corporate boards. In her new memoir, I Am Deborah Lee, the author charts her journey from girlhood in the segregated South to heading the first black company traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And along the way, she offers personal anecdotes, celebrity stories, and lessons about motherhood while trying to make a career. Tonight, Ms. Lee will be in conversation with Tamala Edwards, award-winning reporter and anchor of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition. Please welcome Deborah Lee and Tamala Edwards.
Thank you to everyone who came out tonight. Deborah, where to begin? I loved the book. We talked a little bit in the back. I usually have 2 pages of questions. Tonight I have 4.
So, I'm honored.
I'm going to read here and there from the book because you get into so much for people to think about. And we were talking in the back about voice and making choices. And there's a point in the book where you said, it took a long time for me to hear the sound of my own voice. You write about being a little girl and your father wanting you to be a nice girl. And it didn't, you know, and it was also an impact that financially he had the purse strings on what you would do, college, other things. You had some great mentors, but they were didn't seem to hear you when you said what you wanted to do. It was a pushing you here and there. What did it mean to take so long to find your own voice and to really be able to hear it?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that question, and thank you all for coming out. I'm so excited you're here. This has been a whirlwind week. You know, I think what I really meant, and I think I actually said it, you don't really have to find your voice, you just have to use it. And, you know, not be intimidated by your father, your boss, whatever. And I think I write about how when I first started doing public speaking, my voice used to quiver. It's very noticeable. And when I became COO and had to do town hall meetings and analyst presentation, you know, I was really terrified the day before, the day of, and the day after. It was like a 3-day thing when anyone asked me to speak. And so I had to get over that. But what I'm talking about when I talk about hearing your voice is really being able to use it in boardrooms, in your own senior team meetings, wherever you are when you feel, you know, a certain way. And don't be afraid to express yourself. And I think being a woman, being a black woman, there were so few of us in all rooms. You know, again, boardrooms at the company, that it, you know, I would say, I would speak up when I felt I really had to, but I would also leave meetings saying, oh, I should have said that. Oh, I wish I had said that. Oh, that person made me really mad. Why didn't I say this? And not to be confrontational, but to have the power and use my voice. And that just, it took me years. Even when I became COO, I didn't like going to my own senior team meetings because it was mostly men who weren't invested in my success. They thought they should have my job. We're very clear about it. So it just took years and years of getting used to public speaking, not being afraid to speak up, and learning what was important to me and why, you know, I needed to speak up. If I'm the only black woman in a room, I'm there for a reason, and I should make my presence felt.
There's a line in the chapter, Getting Through the Gauntlet, that I told you I read it, and I had to sit with it for a minute, because it's true of my life and every woman I know. I've never had a female mentor. And it made me stop and think. If I had to think of who was a mentor, who was an advocate, I didn't think about any women.
Yeah.
And
There weren't many around.
There weren't. But one thing, a question I often get, I'm sure when you do events, you have people jump out and say, I want you to be my mentor. There are a lot of people who are going to listen to this podcast. Hopefully, those who can will say, I need to do a better job of being a mentor and an mm-hmm. advocate. But how do you get one? What's the best way?
Well, I spoke in Baltimore last night, and someone asked me, how do you get a mentor? And I said, the quickest way not to get a mentor is to ask somebody to be your mentor. Because if you ask a busy person to be your mentor, all they can think about is, this is going to take up a lot of time. Mm-hmm. I don't know you. Why would I agree just because you came to my speech to be your mentor? So that's not the way. I think the best way is if there's someone you admire, whether it's a female or a male, is to ask that person to coffee. Take a small step. Say, can we have coffee? And then, if that works out, jump to lunch. if that works out, come back 6 months later and try again. I mean, I have people that work for me and have left BET or wherever that I still talk to on a regular basis. And we don't have an official mentor-mentee relationship, mm-hmm. but of course that's what it is. They're younger than I am. I like them. They like me. And, if we're in the same city, we go out for lunch or dinner. And that's the way you start a mentor relationship. And I also make the distinction between mentor and sponsor. Mentor is someone you ask for advice. Sponsor is someone who speaks your name when you're not in the mm-hmm. room and really go to bat for you. And I found out at a certain point when I was at a law firm that the person I thought was my mentor was not my sponsor. Mm-hmm. and when it was time for the law firm to make decisions about partnership, all of a sudden, my rating went from a high of a 1 to a low of a 3 because that person wasn't in the room advocating for me. So it's important to have mentors and sponsors.
Be sure there's somebody in the room speaking for you. Good deal of the book is about Bob Johnson in many different ways. And I wanted to start with him as a boss. Because you're very kind to him in many places in the book. And in fact, I've delineated one passage here. Bob was different. He would become both my mentor and my sponsor. From the beginning, he wanted to see me succeed. He kept stretching me. He'd give me assignments outside the legal department. He believed in the quality of my work and that I could do anything he asked me to do. And that became apparent on my very first day at BET. Meanwhile, he asks you to take a pay cut to start. Mm. He barely gives you a budget.
$18,000, I remember.
Yes, he barely gives you a budget. You have to go buy your own legal books. He gives you a job before you turn around. He's giving you another job, but not more pay, not more attention in terms of your title. And the one that really stayed with me was this. This actually made me mad. This is when the company goes public.
Right.
You made this happen, Deborah said Bob, as the day ended and the group of us headed out to celebrate. Bob and his wife Sheila went to a fancy restaurant uptown to toast the day, while the senior vice presidents hopped in cabs going north on the West Side Highway to have our own celebratory lunch at Robert De Niro's restaurant, the Tribeca Grill. Bob hadn't given any of us stock in the company before the IPO, a regular practice for startups. Today. So while the company's bigwigs have become super rich in minutes, the rest of us were not. It was sobering reality that, to be completely honest, dampened our joy a tad. I was tired reading everything you were doing, and I wondered why you were so kind to him. It was great that he supported you, but I was often angry that you didn't get more or you were given too much to do.
Yeah. Well, at one point, I do get angry. When I asked for like a $5,000 raise to compensate me for all the different jobs I'm doing, and the comp committee said no. And one of the members on the comp committee said, Deborah, if you don't like what Bob pays you, you should leave. There are lots of people who would want your job. And I just thought that was so disrespectful. At that point, I felt like I had to leave the company. I didn't think I could recover from that. The issue about the stock and the executives not having any, we didn't know any better. I'm not sure whether Bob knew better or not and who was advising him on that. But it was something that really demoralized the executive team. you know, we'd all worked hard on it. And, you know, I was the still general counsel, so I was the one at the printer every night after midnight eating M&Ms because they didn't have any other food. It was a little demoralizing. And soon thereafter, I think we got phantom stock or maybe real stock, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we got it, we couldn't sell it for a certain amount of time. But it was a hard time, and I think we all had to make our own decisions as to whether this was the place for us. And Bob, you know, he's a great salesman. He's a visionary. I mean, when you hear him talk, you know, he inspires everybody. You know, I think I say in the book he could sell ice, you know, in the wintertime or in Alaska. I don't know. There was a funny saying we had. And I think he truly cared about us as executives and cared about us as our families and wanting to help us create wealth. But I think early on he just didn't know how to do it. And he made up for it later. I mean, when we went private, the executives made a lot of money. He wanted all the executives to roll over the money into the company, and most of them said no. Most of them said, you know, I was burned once, pay me now. And that made him mad. I think I rolled over half of mine. I was trying to be a team player. And that half I rolled over became more valuable when Viacom acquired us. Hmm. So I did really well, made more money than I ever thought I would. But it was a difficult time. And then at a certain point, was it when Viacom bought us? I think Bob became a billionaire. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all proud of that, but again, it wasn't the same for us.
No. And yet,
you know, he will say to this day that he made more millionaires than any other black company. I think that might be true, even though so last night someone questioned that. But he did. He created wealth for all of us at a certain point. It just wasn't at the very beginning.
Within a year of that meeting, he's sitting there while that man named Herb is telling you, you might as well, you don't like it, go away.
Right.
He makes you chief operating officer. You are on your way out the door. What do you think caused such a turnabout? Or how do you explain how he could go from sitting there watching that meeting to saying, be my number two?
Yeah. I think he knew I was getting ready to throw in the towel. I don't know if he knew how close I was, because I talk about how I was trying to open a toy store, which I thought was the perfect job for a mother. You know, I could take my kids to work or whatever. I said, this town needs more toy stores. So I never got to that. But I think he knew my attitude had changed. And, you know, by that time I was running our publishing division, I was head of business strategy, I was still general counsel. You know, most people, you want your general counsel to focus on legal affairs because mm-hmm. things change. Not that they should be expected to have all the answers, but, you know, so I was becoming afraid that I wasn't doing a good job as general counsel any longer. So I think he decided, I don't know how or why, but decided to offer me this COO position, which I didn't know was ever going to be a possibility. I mean, we thought, all of us thought Bob would stay there to the bitter end. And I guess he realized his kids were too young to be on a trajectory to take over. And I think he was getting antsy about what he wanted to do mm-hmm. next. And so he offered me this job, and I was like, wow, okay, that's one way to solve having too many titles. You just roll them all into one. And so that happened, and I said yes. And then I was met with the wrath of everyone else in the room, you know, all the fellows who thought they had been there longer and deserved it more. And so it was a trying time. But it did let me hire a new general counsel. I was happy about that. I didn't have to worry about the law anymore. And it gave me an overview of the whole company. I had a big learning curve because there were some parts of the company I didn't know about, the advertising sales, mm-hmm. Programming. There were just a lot of areas that I had to learn about. And unfortunately, I had people that weren't interested in helping me learn. You know, they've been hired by Bob. Their loyalty was to Bob, and he had to step totally back from it.
Want you to explain what you did there, because when she says there was disrespect, there were people who showed up in sunglasses and wouldn't take them off, who wouldn't give her the reports. I mean, it was rank disrespect mm-hmm. in front of the crowd. What do you do with that? Because a lot of women listening to this will be in this position.
Yeah. It's hard to deal with because I was trying to do a good job, and these were my friends before this happened. These were the people I would go to Houston's with after senior team meetings and, you know, make jokes about Bob. I mean, we were all on the same level, and all of a sudden they didn't want to have anything to do with me. So it was really isolating, and I just had to become stronger in my management style and tell people what to do as opposed to trying to have a consensual style. And I think a lot of women try to have a consensual, okay, we're all in this together, you know, you go do your thing, but I'll come back. And I just found I had to be more direct. And I had to terminate some people. And some people had to leave on their own. And I had to get more women at the table. I really needed more women to balance out the testosterone. I mean, that's the only way to, I mean, I used to hate going to my own, because they would fight with each other, they would fight with me, you know, and it wasn't fun anymore. You know, it used to be fun. We were all pulling in the same direction. And then after I got the COO title, it was kind of them against me. And I had to get my own team in place. And I think I say in the book, it took me 6 years. 6 years. I had to bring in McKinsey. They had to do an analysis, give me a reason to fire people. You know, consultants, sorry for any consultants in the room, but a lot of times they give you the ammunition to do what you want to do from the beginning. And that's, you know, why I hired a black woman at McKinsey. And she came in, we redid the organizational chart. I demoted some people, which made them even madder. I took away, you know, fiefdoms from people. So it was a really hard time. I just had to, you know, buckle down and survive till I could get my own team in place. And there were always people that were supportive at the company. They didn't all report to me. Sometimes they had to sneak around their boss to come tell me what was really happening. But I did have a lot of support, and especially among the women. When I was appointed COO, I got more high fives from the women in the hallways. That surprised me. You know, they were like, oh, this is such a boys club. I never thought a woman would become COO, and you're the heir apparent. I didn't expect that when I was appointed as COO. All of a sudden, I was treated as the heir apparent as soon as that announcement was made. And I didn't know that's how the corporate world worked. I thought I could be, you know, COOs for a COO for ever. And I was it for 10 years, which I found out was far too long.
Right.
You know, when I was serving on other boards, I learned that most CEOs who accept a job say, I'll do this for, you know, 2 or 3 years. But if I'm not made CEO in that time, I'm leaving. You know, it's not usual for someone to be COO for 10 years. But I did it because I didn't know any better, and, you know, it's a matter of when was Bob going to leave. But I was treated as heir apparent from day one.
We'll get to some more on that in a minute, but when you talk about what it was like to be CEO, OO, and then what you had to do with Bob getting to be CEO, how did you endure? As I read the book, your personal health, your mental health, how did you endure?
Well, at a certain point, I got a therapist who helped me deal with issues. She was almost like an executive coach because so much of what she was giving me advice on related to the company, to my relationship with, you know, people that reported to me and were trying to undermine me, and also my eventual personal relationship with Bob. So I probably could have hired an executive coach for a lot less, but she was very helpful. By the time I went to her, I was, according to her, borderline depressed, but she told me I had anxiety, which she thought I had had all my life. And that really surprised me because I thought I was a cheerful person. I didn't know I was depressed or I knew I was, you know, studied hard, so I didn't flunk because that would have been horrible. But she said, I think you've been anxious all your life, and that's one of the reasons you've been so successful. You know, you've always been prepared, always, you know, ahead of the game. So she worked with me for years. That was helpful. And, you know, by that time, I had two kids that I loved so much, mm-hmm. and they brought me so much joy. Around this time, my marriage was falling apart. Unfortunately, you know, people say, can you have it all? And I say, yeah, you can try. And I definitely wanted it all. I knew from the beginning I wanted kids. And I think my generation was the first generation of women who thought that way. I can have a career mm-hmm. and I can have kids. It's okay. You know, I can find, there is no balance. I'll say that up front, but you know, try to find a way to do it. And I always say, you know, my marriage was what fell by the wayside. That just didn't work on the facts and the circumstances. But anyway, so at a certain point, I was a single mother and divorced. So my kids kept me going. And, you know, I guess family and friends who had no idea what I was going through, but were there to support me.
In the book, actually, when you were married twice,
yes.
Once in your 20s, mm-hmm. and then later to Randy, the father mm-hmm. of your two children. And, you know, because you've written this book for young women and for everybody to read and think about, you know, when you get there, you say you can't succeed at a partnership without approaching it with clear eyes and plenty of communication. The advice sounds obvious, but I can't tell you how many women CEOs I know who assume their marriages would work themselves out. We all know love doesn't pay the bills, but you know what else it doesn't do? It doesn't allocate the percentage of your paycheck that goes to the bills, divide up the house chores, or decide who'll pick up the kids when both parents are working past 8 p.m. So you really get into that. When you look back, do you think it could have been possible with different communication to say, I'm getting to this level, why don't you shift and do this? I think of Ann Fudge, Indra Nooyi, some other people where at the start, the husband said, okay, you go. I got the house.
Right.
Or do you think it's about timing? A husband today would have been willing to hear that, but not back then.
I don't know about a husband today. I mean, I think of the women I know who are CEOs or, you know, very corporate-oriented or highly driven. Some of them have stay-at-home husbands. Some of them are not married. Some of them have, you know, very supportive husbands who, although they may work, pick up a lot of tasks that you normally would think of the, you know, mother-wife would do. So I think people just have to work it out. And as I said, I think one of the issues Randy and I had was that it just started happening so quickly. I was, you know, traveling more and more. I was making more money. And all of a sudden, what we thought was this very equal relationship wasn't equal anymore. And I think the thing that really changed it is having kids. You know, you can be as equal as you want to before kids. But after kids, especially in the early years, the female ends up taking the bulk of the load. You know, you have to get up and breastfeed in the middle of the night. You have to take maternity leave. And it's hard to maintain that equal relationship. And in my case, the new factor was, you know, making more than my husband. And I talk about that. You know, in the beginning, we split everything equally. Well, when I start making more, do I start paying more? And we tried that for a while. I think if you're not talking about it, if you're not clear, if you're not able to define non-traditional mm-hmm. roles in a marriage, it's hard to maintain.
You're COO, and then you become CEO, and well, eventually. And you, in the book, take pains to say the relationship with Bob did not happen till after you had been appointed COO. So about
right.
6 months after, things began to occur. And the difference I noticed is when you talk about your first two relationships, it's just love in the beginning. We're taking walks. We're so happy. It's a little bit different, and I'm going to read that section for sure from the book when you describe things beginning with Bob. You go and, you know, he's starting to do things, and you're like, where are we going? What's happening here? What's happening here? And you have to go to his hotel room to meet him. And he says to you, meet me in my room and we'll go down together. You get there and he's shirtless. And instead of taking the bait, you step back and you're like, okay, Bob, we're going downstairs. And you think to yourself, what's he doing? I mean, I knew exactly what he was doing, but the dance, the chase, whatever this was, felt almost choreographed. And I was falling into preordained steps. And you go a little longer and you say, still, you know, I've been married twice. I knew what I was doing, but still something about this situation with Bob never felt like it was completely in my control. Even from the beginning, it felt as though the choice wasn't quite yours, that this was a different, you don't talk about him the way you do mm-hmm. your two husbands.
Yeah. And by this time, I had been working for Bob for over 10 years. You know, he'd been, as I said, he pushed me, he'd been very supportive of me, he knew my old family, you know, always willing to help. And so this kind of came out of the blue, it kind of surprised me. But, you know, when I look back on it, and even at the time I knew this, that there would be consequences if I said no. You know, as the wooing went on, and, you know, it's like, okay, but when would it happen? Would it happen, you know, when I said no? Would it happen if, you know, we started a relationship and it didn't work out? You know, when is this other shoe going to drop? So, yeah, it was almost like, you know, I had no choice. Now, people will say, and people on Twitter have said, well, why didn't she just leave? You know, why didn't she just say no? They were both married, you know, and all of that's valid. And I just want to make it clear, I'm not playing the victim in this book at all. I try to tell it very authentically, and this is what happened, and this is how I found myself in this relationship. And, you know, I could have at that time, but at that time I was already named COO. It was clear I was on the track to be CEO. And did I want to leave all that behind? And I love BET. I love what I was doing. You know, I guess I cared for Bob in a way. And for maybe a while, I thought it was consensual. You know, I thought I had made a decision, even though I knew what the two decisions were, mm-hmm. or the alternatives. But it felt like a relationship. You know, we would go out together, we travel together, and, you know, we eventually both got divorced, and then we were going out and people knew we were in a relationship. And then as time went on, you know, we started disagreeing on more things, whether it related to the business or to our personal lives or whatever. And, you know, it turned into something that I wanted to get out of. And that's when the harassment started, mm-hmm. when I was told, well, if you break up with me, you have to leave tomorrow. Tomorrow, not, you know, we'll do a nice goodbye for you and I'll give you a reference that, you know, maybe we could stay, or not that I'm going to leave in a year, or, you know, it's just so cut and dry. And then I really realized what I had gotten myself into. And it was a result of an unequal power relationship. You know, as my boss and chairman of the company, he had all the power. And I used to hold on to the fact that I was already offered the COO before the relationship started as proof that no one could say I slept my way mm-hmm. to the top. I mean, I was already at the top. But, you know, it always bothered me, and always something that I kept saying, this is just harassment. And so eventually he left, and I made it till when, you know, again, with a lot of therapy, and you can hold on for 18 months, and it's going to be all right, and you're going to be CEO, and he's going to be gone. And so that happened, but it wasn't until Time's Up and Me Too that I started hearing other women's stories that I was like, wow, this is really an issue in the media world, in the entertainment world, in the corporate world, in all worlds, you know, that women are still dealing with this. And, you know, I had a little PSDT, you know, when I started hearing those stories. And I went to a couple of meetings and, you know, signed up to be supportive. And by this time I had moved to LA. But I would go to those meetings and I couldn't tell my story. One time I tried to and I started crying. You know, they would have separate meetings for Black women. And I think it was that, and when I finally left BET, that I was like, I have to tell my story, because my story is different from most stories, but it's still a story that young women should know about and be warned about and understand what the consequences can be.
Well, let's put a finer point on it. I mean, to the outward world, you were this executive at the top. You looked as though you had it all, could do everything, doing 12 different jobs.
Right.
Meanwhile, you were walking around your house disconnecting all the phones because he wouldn't stop calling. He used the private jet to turn up at your vacation, you know, where you were with your children. Some of these fights would get physical. and you couldn't talk to anybody about it.
Right.
And I would imagine also you're trying to metabolize in your mind the man you knew in the beginning who would give you anything. Could you have ever predicted he would become this person?
No. He was, and one of my friends said to me, well, you're very kind to Bob for three-fourths of the book. And I was like, well, he was my boss. He was supportive. He was funny. He was charming. You know, he treated us like a family, sort of. You know, they would we'd go on trips together, you know, the team. And, you know, he was a great boss for a long time. And I could have never anticipated anything like this happening. I will say there were rumors about him and other women, but they were just...
You never heard about him behaving this way?
No.
You said something really interesting in the book about the arguments over you becoming CEO. And it really stood out to me. You know, the timeline, as you pointed out, for the transition for most number twos is about 2 years, three tops. It took me 10. Not because I wasn't ready. Bob wasn't. I'm convinced that he was not only holding on to his title, his position, his power... He was holding on to me. Bob didn't want to let me go. Did you become BET, one synonymous Deborah BET? He couldn't let either one of you go. To let you go would be to let BET go, and he could not imagine that.
That's a good way to look at it. That's a good way to, and he did have a hard time letting BET go. Even though he said he was ready, you know, once he left, he kept calling me, you know, trying to make suggestions about programming and other things. And it was still, you know, a bad relationship. I mean, he had a hard time. And, you know, he had lots of other things going on. It wasn't that he was trying to retire or anything. But, you know, for both of us, became Bob was BET, BET was Bob. That was true for a long time, even after he left. People were, all, you know, for years would say to me, how's Bob? I was like, yeah, I don't know. I haven't talked to him recently. And, you know, that just stopped maybe 5 years ago when people started realizing that I was running the company and that he was really gone. So, yeah, I think it was difficult for him.
You said something surprising to me on GMA where you explained to Robin, essentially you felt trapped. But he was saying, well, then fine, get out now. I wouldn't have a letter of recommendation. Single mother with two kids, what was I going to do? And I'm saying, but you're Deborah Lee. You get hired next Tuesday. You've run a company, everybody already knew you.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of women who think, I'm an everyday lady. No, I could never. This would ruin my life. They look at you and think, but you could have walked out. And obviously you are an example that at any level this can get to you.
Right.
Why didn't you believe I don't need his letter. I don't need him. I can walk out of here.
Because I was so attached to the hip to him in the view of other people. Oh, Bob's CEO, Deborah's COO. You know, he brought her into this. He taught her everything he knew. He, you know, recommended her to be CEO. So I just didn't think that the world was ready for a woman to say, no, you know, we were in a relationship and it was going badly and I just want to get out of here. I don't think, well, first of all, I'm a black woman. You know, let's start there. There are not that many black female CEOs, even to this day. That's the other reason I wanted to write the book. We just, you know, we're still unicorns. And so I'm not sure who would have said, first of all, a lot of people would have been afraid to make Bob mad. So there goes the black media world. And if I was trying for the white media world, you know, and didn't have a great letter of rec coming from the guy I worked for 20 years, I don't think it would have been as easy as it sounds. I know it wouldn't have been. I would have had to do a lot of explaining, and it would have brought a lot of things to light that I probably didn't want to bring to light at the time because I hadn't really dealt with them. So it was a pretty impossible situation. And you're right. People are looking, reading book, and probably saying, what is she talking about? She could have left. You know, she made enough money, she probably didn't have to work again, which wasn't true at the time, but, you know, eventually it became true. But I think I was just afraid of the backlash from Bob and from public.
Sitting in this seat now, two questions. You know, your children witnessed some of this. What do you talk about in this time, in this journey, when you talk to Ava about it? Your daughter.
Well, telling both of my kids, the truth about the relationship took me years and a lot of therapy. And I waited till they were both adults, and then it still took me a couple of years, because one of the hardest things to do is tell your children you're not perfect. It's not a great thing to do as a parent. They knew at some point I was dating Bob. They didn't know it started when I was still married to their dad. So actually telling them took a lot of time. And then, you know, with Ava, I could tell her a few more things than I wanted to tell Quinn. But when I told them, they were both very supportive and said, Mom, you know, my daughter said, I'm sorry this happened, you know, but if, and I think I mentioned I was thinking about writing a book at the time, and they were both supportive of that. But it was very hard to sit down with them and say, this is really how my life went. And, you know, maybe other parents in the room will relate to it. I mean, I know my parents had an affair before they got married. We didn't know about it till, you know, 50 years. We were 50 years old before we knew about it. And they'd probably be mad I'm talking about it now.
I find family Christmas parties are great. When people get drunk, they start, I didn't know my mother was the second wife till people started drinking. Yeah.
Well, to be honest, one day I was in the Cheesecake Factory with my kids, and I said something about my first husband. They were like, what? What? You were married?
Yes.
And it just had never come up. I wasn't trying to hide it.
That guy.
Yeah. It just, we didn't have children. When we divorced, we went separate ways. He was a doctor, and we were only married 2 years. So it's not, you know, and it just never came up, but they were really mad at me.
You know, you're not supposed to have a life really before
right.
them. Has Bob ever apologized to you?
No.
Do you think he ever will?
Nope.
Do you need it?
Nope.
That's the victory.
Yeah. That's a lot of therapy. No, I don't. I you know, it was, and you know, people would say, why are you telling us about a black man and black women should support black? You know, we hear all of that. You heard that with the Russell Simmons mm-hmm. allegations. And, you know, I don't buy into that. I'm like, black men should behave better if they're having issues, you know. And so, again, there are so many layers to this that I've had to think about, and what will people say, and can I take it, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, that I've just dealt with over the years.
You've talked about the social media, and I would always tell you, don't read the comments.
Yeah, I don't read
the things that people have to say, and my reaction to some of it was, you know, Bob was a grown man making decisions for himself. Why is all the criticism aimed at her?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a level of misogynoir in that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, I think women always get the blame, or a lot of times, I shouldn't say always. And I don't know why. And I know, you know, people that are happily married for 40 years can look at this and say, well, you know, should have never happened in the first place. And that's true. It should never happen in the first place. But things happen. And I think, you know, the way you handle it is the most important.
And turning from this, you go on, your CEO, there's so many things that you're so proud of. Little by little, you remake the network, getting rid
right.
of the bikini girls at the pool party and the rappers and scripted shows that are winning awards. So
mm-hmm.
many things that you're proud of. And you have some interesting stories about the friends you made along the way and the things you learned. It opens with a story about Aretha, and towards the end there's a story about Oprah. Now, Aretha wants, you know, a winter wardrobe and all these things, and you're like, I'm not doing it, but you take her calls and you stay on the phone with her, and she comes to respect you mm-hmm. and like you. It takes you a minute to figure out if you're friends.
Right.
But she teaches you a lot
yeah.
in pushing the envelope and yet respecting someone who pushes back. On the other end is Oprah, who wants to run ads on your network
right.
and calls you and I don't even know the word for it. And you're just like, Oprah, that's not done. You don't see ads for NBC on ABC. And she says, well, I just don't walk in the world like that. Almost as if she was trying to shame you
yeah.
to put her ads on.
Right.
And I wondered what you took out of those two different bookends, those two giants, and such different responses to
yeah.
being pushed back against.
Wow, that's an interesting question. you really read this book.
I underlined a lot of this book.
I'm really impressed. Well, what I learned from Aretha, she was very direct of what she wanted, and she would always come to me, the top. She wouldn't go to my people, whoever was doing the award show, she wouldn't ask them. She just called me directly. I want a winter wardrobe. And I'm saying, but she's from Detroit. She should have a winter wardrobe. It's not like she's coming from the Virgin Islands or something. And I just had to learn to tell her no. And, you know, it wasn't hard because I didn't have the money for a winter wardrobe. So even if I wanted to give it to her, I couldn't. So I just respected her about that. And she taught me how to respect myself and say out loud what you want, you know. And if someone says no, accept it and go back to what you're doing.
But you might get a winter wardrobe. You don't know if you don't ask.
Yeah. I heard later Kennedy Center gave her a winter wardrobe when she got the Kennedy Center honor. They have more money than I had. So I think with Oprah, it was a little bit convoluted. You know, instead of just saying, I want to buy. I mean, she started out by saying, I hear you have a personal problem with me. And I was like, Oprah, I really don't. What are you talking about? And she said, yeah, my people say there's something going on between us. And I said, no. And I had called my people beforehand to ask me what she was calling about. And so I knew it was about ad sales. And so I said, is this about you wanting to buy, your people wanting to buy? And we always say your people, so don't make it personal. And so wanting to buy ad spots on BET. And she said, yeah. And I don't understand why you would say no. And I said, no, because you're a competitor. And you're going after a black audience now. And I'm not going to deliver my audience on a silver tray to you. And then that's when she said, well, it's more important to me how you walk through the world. I said, what? And she's in the TV business. She always has been. So it's like, well, no, it's very competitive. And, you know, we all get Nielsen ratings in the morning, so we know who won the night before. And I said, I'm all about winning, you know. And she said, well, it must be like me and when Phil Donahue called me when I had my show in Chicago. And she said, he called me and he said, I wish you good luck in all time periods except mine. And I said, yeah, it's very much like that. I said, except I'm running a 24-hour network. So I'm not giving up anything.
And she was frosty for a while.
Yeah, we didn't have, I mean, you know, we weren't close beforehand. We knew each other. But yeah, I felt a little frosty for a while. But I'm sure she, you know.
She understands
that. Yeah,
it.
I think she understood it at the time. She was just trying to.
You write you in the book talking about your son, Quinn. You have two children. Quinn was your oldest one. He's a son. Your daughter, Ava. He was known as DJ Spicoli. He was a DJ making a way in the world. COVID hit him hard. The isolation, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, you talk about all of it. Mm-hmm. And you lost him to depression.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. At the time, you did not give details, and it's just now that you're willing and ready to talk about what happened more.
Right. You know, it's the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with, and I love him so much, and I miss him every day, and, you know, he was my guy, and the bear hugs, he was such a loving person and so inclusive. You know, he wanted everyone around him, you know, black, white, piercings, tattoos, no piercing. I mean, he was just that kind of person. Mm-hmm. He was always bringing people together. He's a DJ, and people were always going to his events. And he seemed happy as a lark, just happy. He just always was a happy guy. And when he became depressed, you know, we tried to get him as much help as we could. It was hard in COVID. I couldn't even hug him because I have diabetes, and he was scared to, you know, he might give me COVID or whatever. And, you couldn't do therapy in person. You could do it via Zoom, but it was hard. And we thought he was doing better. And then, he just decided to give up. And I'll never know why, but I know, you know, he was one of the most important things in my life. So I write about him in the epilogue. This happened while I was writing the book. And continuing to write the book helped me get through some of it. So I didn't want to, you know, make the book about him, but I wanted to acknowledge that he had passed and how much I miss him. And, you know, it feels like sometimes there's a mental health epidemic mm-hmm. among young Black men. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to explain it or, you know, what, but I still find it hard to believe that my son was part of that. But he was so encouraging to me and always loved what I did. In fact, cute little story, while he was going through therapy via Zoom, he called me one day and he said, "Mom, have I ever had any trauma in my life?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure, Quinn. Maybe when your dad and I split up." He said, "No, that wasn't traumatic." And I was like, "Well, you know, don't make anything up. Why?" And he said, "They're asking me about it in therapy." And I said, "Well, if you don't remember it, I don't remember anything." And I just thought that was so reflective of the kind of person he was. He's like, "Trauma? What trauma?" So I've invested in a mental health insurance company that makes sure all employers provide mental health care for the children of their employees, because we found out that a lot of them don't. It's just for employees, not for... And I started a fund for internships at the Recording Academy in Quinn's honor. It's called the Quinn Coleman Internship. And I met with five of them during Grammy week, and they were so appreciative mm-hmm. and wanted to hear all about Quinn. So I'm still trying to figure out how to deal with it and dealing with the grief and, you know, with our family, Randy and Ava and friends, you know, we're just dealing with it. And you don't understand why these things happen. But as you and I were talking before we came in here, it's a serious mm-hmm. illness. And it's something that, you know, was very pervasive during COVID. And I think we're still seeing the effects of it, and will for many years to come.
I know if I ask you what you're proudest of, you're going to say your children. Yeah, so I'm going to ask you, as a mom, I know.
Right.
The next thing that you're proud of, and what are your dreams for yourself for the future?
Oh, wow. I'm allowed to have dreams for myself.
You're allowed to have dreams.
I'm really not even that person. I've been, you know, living out so many other people's dreams. What am I proudest of behind my children? I guess being able to give young African Americans opportunities at BET that they wouldn't get other places. I mean, that's the thing that kept me going. And to give someone an opportunity and see them soar is just incredible. And I think that's, you know, people used to say, "What do you want your legacy to be?" I said, "Well, I want to be able to say I gave people opportunity, even if they left BET." You know, the fact that they were there and contributed. You know, of course, there are high points with programming and going, being the first Black company on the New York Stock Exchange. So I'm just, you know, I guess I'm proud of my career. And as you say, of course, so proud of my kids. And what do I dream about? I dream about getting through this book tour. It's been a grueling week. But no, I dream about, you know, my daughter being as successful as she wants to be and being happy. I'm really into happiness right now. I want everyone to be happy and self-care. And you know, I want to have time for self-care. I mean, this is my retirement, so I'm busier than I thought I would be. I'm on four corporate boards, and you heard the introduction. But, you know, I just want to, you know, have time to enjoy life and enjoy my family and my friends. And, you know, I may have one or two
more adventures.
Surprises along the way. But every time I mention something to my daughter, she's like, "Why would you do that? Like, aren't you retired?" So I don't know. I did, you know, writing this book was important to me, and I'm proud of it.
And we should mention her daughter, Ava, is a writer on Abbott Elementary. Yeah. So she's kind of Philly connected.
Yeah, she loves it. She really loves it. So
so I've asked a million questions.
Yeah, we've got time.
Okay, anybody? Because you see, I can keep going right there.
Okay, my name is Leah. I also wrote a memoir.
Oh, did you?
Yes. My question, I have 100 questions for you, but I'll just have to take one.
Okay.
If you were financially independent completely, would you have tolerated what you tolerated with the last person you were with?
He wasn't the last person I've with. I've had a couple of boyfriends since then. So, that was a long time ago now. But thank you for that. I don't know. I mean, the thing that kept me in the relationship when it started going bad was BET and all the people that worked for me. I mean, there were some women that I told when I was leaving, they'd start crying. They're like, oh, you can't leave. Does the board know? I'm like, yeah, the board knows. It's 32 years. It's a done deal. But that was such an important part of my life, that being financially independent would have helped. But I really think a lot of it was about, you know, how much I wanted to run BET and be successful at that. Even after Bob left and, you know, I was CEO for 13 years. And that's a long time. I found out later that CEOs don't even last that long. It's 4 or 5 years. But I wanted to prove to the world that I could do it, that, you know, I deserved it, I could do it, I could transform BET. And that was really important to me. And when I finally left, I felt like I had done, you know, as much as I could do. I wanted to do more. But, it, you know, they tell you, you know when it's time to leave. But that's a good question, yeah.
Thank you so much
for everything that you shared. I'm only a few chapters into the book. The note about Patti LaBelle being upset about Uncut being, that was hilarious. But anyway, I have a question about...
I hope she doesn't mind I said that, but she did fool me. Uncut was this video show that we had on at 3 o'clock in the morning that was pretty risque. In fact, I never saw it before I took over. And it was the first thing I canceled when I took over. Yeah. Because it was pretty risque videos.
But I have a question. If you have any thoughts about the state of television right now, but specifically Black media, really. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'm happy to say there are a lot more alternatives now. There are a lot more fully targeted networks toward African American, and other networks have realized that we're a really loyal audience, and if you give us high quality authentic programming, we will show up. So a lot of networks have their Black nights, whether it's Bravo with Wednesday or VH1 with Monday night. And then with the streaming services, there are a lot more opportunities. So it's a good time to be a producer or actor or director in the Black space, because there's a lot of demand for it. I just hope the door stays open longer. You know, sometimes the door opens and then it closes quickly. And now Asians and Latinos are asking for their time, and, you know, they should have their time. I think this Academy Awards on Sunday night is going to be amazing for Asians. You know, we should all be included. And it's all about inclusion and not making decisions based on whether you think it's a Black show or a white show. I mean, so many shows have proven that all kind of people want to watch. When we had on a New Edition miniseries, and it did really well, you know, all kinds of white people were coming up to me saying, oh, I love that show, and, you know, that was the best show. I grew up on New Edition, or Being Mary Jane, or The Game, or some of the other shows. So I don't think it needs to be segregated. A good story is a good story, whether it's, you know, features Latinos or Asians or Black folks or a mixture of all of them. How about that? With Being Mary Jane, we were very intentional on not doing what Friends did to Black people, pretending like there were no Black people in New York City. So Mary Jane's producer was Hispanic. The manager of the television network was white. You know, we tried to mix it up. We wanted it to look like the real world. And I think, you know, hopefully more places are doing that. I love the success of Abbott Elementary, and that everyone that, you know, you mentioned it to says, oh, I love that show. And, you know, it's the number one show. It's doing great. And I think because Quinta Brunson, you know, mixed it up. Different teachers, different stories. And, you know, it's not just one kind of story. So I hope that is the way media goes.
So thank you very much for writing a book and for having this session tonight. I just found out about your book this morning.
Oh, really?
On the radio. And oh. I was like, I have to get tickets.
And was it the Steve Harvey show?
NPR.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I heard Steve Harvey talked about it this morning. I was like, I haven't heard that one yet.
So I'm just curious about your process for writing a book, because you've lived obviously an amazing life, and being a Black woman CEO says it all, right? So how did you go about condensing all of that and kind of remembering, you know, like the special things? And then was there anything really surprising as you were going through and piecing everything together? Was there anything that was really surprising to you that, you know, stood out?
Well, my process was, I started with stories I tell over and over, because I've been doing public speaking for a long time after I got over my quivering voice. And people started asking me to be dinner speakers or whatever. So I have, you know, my favorite stories that I know where people laugh, and I know, you know, they write me notes and say, oh, I really appreciated that story. One of which is the story when I had to go to New York right after Quinn was born. And, you know, my breasts were hard as rocks, and I had to pump in the bathroom at the law firm and pour the breast milk down the toilet. So every time I tell that story, it really proves the point that women are different and men don't understand. And the people I were meeting with were all men. And so they had no idea what I was doing. But anyway, so I started with that. I also knew the challenges in my life that I wanted to deal with. And I don't want to spoil everything for people who haven't read the book, but one of them was that I had an abortion before I went to law school, between my finishing college and starting law school. I had never talked about that publicly. And I wanted to tell that story because, you know, Roe v. Wade was decided 3 years before I had to make that decision. And I had the right to choose. And now women are losing that right. So I wanted to be part of that discussion. And Planned Parenthood has been trying to get women who have had abortions to come out and talk about it. So I knew I wanted that to be part of the book. You know, I knew I had some pretty funny celebrity stories because of my career. You know, I just, well, the first thing I did was come up with a book proposal where I tried to put it all in a way that made sense. And I wanted it to be primarily business advice. That was the start. And then I wanted it to be part memoir and to tell those stories that related to the business advice so that people would remember the stories. Now, not every publisher I talked to agreed with that approach. Some of them were like, oh, you got to make up your mind. It can't be a memoir and a business book. But then the publisher I ended up with said, yeah, no, that makes sense. And so she let me write the book that I wanted to write, which was great. But anyway, and so then it was just, you know, I worked with a collaborator and just telling stories over and over and over. And next thing you know, it was a book. People have said it really feels like they're sitting down talking to me over a glass of wine. And that's the way I wanted it to feel. And there are no photos in the book, because it's supposed to be a business book. So, you know, you don't see me at 2 years old or when I went to college, when I went to law school. So it was a great process for me. I'm not a journaler, and I don't have the greatest memory in the world. I mean, in terms of dates, you know, unless it has something to do with my kids or, you know, promotion or something, you know. So a lot of things I had to research and ask other people, do you remember what year was that Chris Brown performed? So there was some research attached to it. But I've never been a journaler, so I didn't have that to start off with. But it was, you know, I wanted to make it interesting. I wanted to make it funny. I like humor. And I wanted it to be truthful and tell the full story.
So we're wrapping up, and as we leave, I do have to ask you, what would you think about Tyler Perry or Byron Allen? The rumors that they might buy BET.
You did have to go there.
I gave you the right to say it.
I've been trying to avoid that question all week. It was funny that announcement came out the day my book came out. Tyler's doing so much programming in a programming deal with BET. He's got 90 hours a year. So he's doing a lot of it. So, you know, it would make sense. I knew that was probably always his goal. And I think, you know, a lot of Tyler. Byron, you know, I don't know as well, but he's a great businessman. So I think it's going to be interesting to see who ends up with BET. And I was surprised that Paramount was ready to let it go, because people have called over the years, you know, asking to buy it. So it'll be an interesting process. But whoever, I don't have a horse favored. Or a dog in right. this fight.
Well, whoever it is would be smart to come and pick your brain.
Oh, that's
well,
so sweet.
Thank you to all of you who came out this evening. Deborah, thank you for writing the book
thank
and spending
you.
This time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.